The importance of marriage today cannot be underestimated. It's the first institution of God, and there's so many problems in society as a result of the attack on marriages today, and how people are even trying to rewrite what a family is defined, and what is a marriage defining it, redefining it. And I got to tell you, those attempts will utterly fail. They will not work. You go against God's ordered plan, and just like anything else, you know, if you go your own way and do your own thing, you can. You have the freedom to do that. But just understand, you will not find the satisfaction that God intended for you to have if you go His way. I found out that the Russian translation of my marriage book, was, which has been out for the past 2 months in Russia, they've already sold like 300 copies just from mail order and a couple of Christian bookstores. So that was just from that small outlet, was quite an amazing response. And especially in that culture, there's a great need for stability in marriage. You know, under the communist regime, you know, the state was more important than the family. A family was just was a non-essential. And the kids, getting them away from the family and training them in state organizations, was much more to be desired. And now that society is in shambles because of that. God said, hey, the family, husband, wife, man and a woman coming together, one flesh. That's what God says. If you have a different opinion about it, you're welcome to it. But it won't work the way God intended it. So this is what the Lord has said. And you know what? When you think about what our own society has encountered in the last 30, 40 years. You know, the post-World War kids, 80% of them, according to statistics, were raised in families that both mother and father were in the home, married to each other. Now, in the 80s and the 90s, we saw less than 50% of the young people were in homes that the husband and wife were married together. Now it's even worse, but those kids that were there in the 80s are now going to be the parents of the year 2000. And what kind of foundation are they laying? Statistics show that those who grew up in families of divorce are 6 times more likely to be poor, 3 times more likely to have social adjustment problems, higher dropout rates, higher teen pregnancy, higher abuse of drugs, 3 times more likely to commit teen suicide. The young boy that just threw himself in front of a train with his girlfriend came from a broken home down in Florida just this last Wednesday. And you know, the sad thing is, of all these things, Hollywood celebrates this liberation from traditional values. And in celebrating it, many, many people are trying to rewrite it and redefine it. And I love what the old saying among the Jews was, every divorce is the death of a small civilization. You do not know the legacy you leave when you remain strong together for your family. I was very encouraged by an anniversary card my daughter gave my wife and I yesterday. It was our 23rd anniversary. And she was extolling us for loving each other and the security that gave her over the years and the model it was for her as she's going to be getting married in a few months. And she said, especially, I didn't appreciate it when I was younger, but now I look at how many of my friends and people that I knew at school have come from broken homes and just what it's done to them and how hard it's been for them. And so she was appreciated the fact that we love each other. And you know, that's the best thing you can do for your kids, husbands and wives, is love each other. That's the best gift you can give to them. There's nothing like that. And, you know, I remember how the kids used to love when they were little. When they got in their teen years, they said, yeah, they don't do that. But they were young. They'd love those displays of affection, you know, and they just felt so secure. And if I'd be hugging my wife, they'd want to just get right in the middle of it, and they'd cuddle right in. And there's just something real secure about that for kids. So why the focus here on Song of Solomon? Well, it's because God made marriage. And He wants marriages to be on fire and enkindled with affection and romance and love and eroticism, yes, and all that goes along with marriage because God made it that way. And we left off in the last chapter, in chapter 6, with the conflict that they'd experienced, which is a part of normal marriages. You go through those adjustments and you learn how to die to yourself and you miscommunicate and then you have to work that out. That's normal. You know, my wife and I think I've said before, we don't have fights. We just have intense fellowship at times. But it's all a part of marriage. It's all a part of what it is. So we left off with this. And, you know, now they've come back and they've been restored and kind of the makeup time together and being with each other. In chapter 6, we saw that. But we now come to something that is even better, because restored fellowship is very important. not only in a marriage, but also as a Christian. David, at the time when he was disobedient to God, that whole year, he said his bones were all dried up. He was miserable. He was unhappy as he tried to cover his sin. See, there's the worst sin in the world is the sin you try to cover. When you try to cover it and justify it, extenuate it, excuse it, it's the worst sin in the world because it will destroy you. It will make you miserable. It'll eat you up. God does not want you to cover it. He wants you to confess it, to openly confess it, to say the same thing about it as God says, to see it as he sees it. Do you see the sin of your life as putrid as God sees it? Because that's how God sees it. And if you don't see it that way, then you haven't truly confessed it. You're still trying to justify it and extenuate it. Don't do that, because until you get it out in the open with the Lord, then you can't have that joy of your salvation restored. And just as in a marriage, it's great to come to that place where you work through those issues and you come now together and the joy of that marriage is restored. So it is with our relationship with the Lord, because we can't forget as we look at marriage and as we look at this intimate expression of marital life, that this is a type of Christ and the church, the intimacy God desires with each of us. But let's look at this passage now. Now, I want you to back up to the last verse of the previous chapter, chapter 6, verse 13, because there's a change here now. There's a focus now. He says, "Return, return, O Shulamite, return, return, that we may look upon you." That is, we may gaze upon you, that we may feast our eyes on you. And the Shulamite says, what would you see in the Shulamite? As it were, the dance of the two camps. And we looked at how difficult that was, a little difficult to understand what's being said here, until you get to the next chapter, and then it kind of opens up what's being expressed. Because what's happening in chapter 7 is she is going to dance before him, an intimate, erotic dance for her husband. And if the previous chapters were worthy of blushing, this next chapter is even more so, and I'm going to try to keep this as PG as possible, but it's pretty wild. He goes from the bottom of her feet to the top of her head and describing how beautiful she is as she is dancing before him. And how we know that is by a couple of words here. In verse 1, he says, "How beautiful are your feet in sandals, O prince's daughter. The curves of your thighs are like jewels." Now, the word curve in the Hebrew is a word that actually is better translated the motion of your thighs. He's speaking of her dance before him. Now, why would she dance before him? At this stage in their relationship, what's very important to understand is they've come to realize what this foundation of love is, and that is seeking to please each other. She is doing something that may not come natural to her, but she's seeking to please him. She's seeking to be pleasant to him, but there's also the fact that she's totally secure in his love. She's totally uninhibited. In fact, what you learn here is that any type of inappropriate prudishness that often is in marriage causes problems, and you need to shed that in a marriage because the marriage bed is undefiled. You know, any excessive reserve by women or any inappropriate vulgarities by men are not fitting in the marriage relationship. But she takes the initiative here, and she's expressing herself to her husband, and now he is, in response, praising her as she does. So he says, "Your navel is a rounded goblet. It lacks no blended beverage." By navel, that's a very kind word for the translators, and that's all I'm going to say. "Your waist is a heap of wheat set about with lilies." Now, you're not going to get a whole lot of mileage out of this phrase in the English. It's not going to be very good to say to your wife, "Your waist is a heap of wheat." Not going to have the same effect, but understand that this is a compliment here. "Your two breasts are like two fawns, twins of a gazelle. Your neck is like an ivory tower. Your eyes are like pools in Heshbon by the gate of Bath Rabban." That was in Moab, by the way, and it was well known for its reservoirs, its pools. And he uses that emblem. "Your nose is like the Tower of Lebanon, which looks toward Damascus." Again, a compliment then? Now, not. "Your head crowns you like Mount Carmel, and the hair of your head is like purple. A king is captivated by your tresses." Now, in this description, of course, he's very much entranced by her as she motions before him. And he continues to praise her. Now, as she has held him in captivity here, you know, I love this, that there's not a fantasy here, but rather there's not others involved. There's no other images brought into this. I think it's a big mistake when couples use any type of pornography to try to, you know, spice up their life together. It's a big mistake. Because do you lack the imagination to learn how to enjoy each other? Do you lack the self-control in your own thoughts to choose to let your partner satisfy you? That you have to bring other images in, which actually will only decrease the satisfaction you have with your partner. It's not a good move. Here, they are in their season together, and who knows how long they've been together in this relationship. Remember, there's the stages of this marriage. There was the courtship, there was the beginning honeymoon, there was the conflict stage, and now they're in that sweet season learning how to please each other stage, and actually they've learned how to please each other. Now they're pleasing each other. He says, "How fair and how pleasant you are, O love, with your delights. The stature of yours is like a palm tree, and your breasts are like its clusters. I said, I will go up to the palm tree, take hold of its branches. Let now your breasts be like clusters of the vine, the fragrance of your breath like apples, and the roof of your mouth like the best wine." Whew, okay. Let's move on. "The wine goes down smoothly for my beloved, moving gently the lips of sleepers." The idea there is that now they've just settled in, they've been intimate with each other, and now they're just embracing each other and they're falling asleep together. Now I want you to notice in verse 10, because verse 10 is repeated three times in this book. And each time it's repeated, there's a slight change in the form. And it actually gives to us something that we can have a glimpse, not just in the marriage as the picture of the maturity of marriage, but we also see a greater glimpse into this relationship we have with the Lord from this particular verse. This is a very, very key verse in this, because anytime you see anything repeated, there's kind of like any type of biblical hermeneutics, which is interpreting the Bible. Anytime something is repeated, it should get your attention. It's important. God is emphasizing it. Here, what's being emphasized? She said, "I am my beloved's and my desire is toward me." Now, the first time she uses this, it's a little bit different. In chapter 2, verse 16, during their courtship, she said, "My beloved is mine." She starts out with that and says, "I am his." Now, that emphasis was on her possessing him. And that would be natural in the courtship stage. You know, she's got the ring, she's on her finger, she's got the promise, she's got the ketubah there, you know, to show that his commitment, the written agreement, that their engagement is there and that he's coming back for her. But, you know, there's that little bit of insecurity there. You know, my beloved's is mine, you know, I'm claiming him, he's mine. The second time she mentions this in chapter 6, verse 3, she said, "I am my beloved's and my beloved is mine." It's like now they're married, they're more secure, that him possessing her is the primary emphasis there. In other words, she's secure. I am my beloved's. He wants me, that I'm his. And so she's thinking in terms of that security there. Now this time is even a greater step toward the assurance, because she said, "I am my beloved's and his desire is toward me." She knows she's got a little woman power here. She knows she's got him. She knows she's captivated him. She's got him eating out of the palm of her hand, so to speak. But it's a great thing because it gives her an assurance. She's totally a confident woman. She's not inhibited. She's just totally open to her husband. And she goes, "I am my beloved's and his desire is for me, not anyone else." And I love this. It's a great picture. It's a great picture of that relationship security. Now, how much more I see that same picture among the young Christians when you first start out. There's that concept when you first come to the Lord, your big concern is, do you have the Lord? Is he yours? You know, he's mine. He's mine. I need him in my life. There's a little insecurity there. You know, you want to have that assurance. But after you're with him for a while, and after you've come to really enjoy the Lord and you've experienced his love presented to you, you're a little more secure there and you go, "I am my beloved's. He does love me. God does love me." Then there comes that place of maturity as a Christian that's even more special. that you've been through the conflicts, you've been through the difficulties, you've wrestled with the Lord, you've wrestled over theology and the situations you can't understand in the Bible, and maybe you even at first were disagreeing with, but now you've submitted yourself to the Lord, you believe His Word, and you've got this sense of His presence in a way that you can say, I am my beloved's and His desire is toward me. You know, if God is for you, who can be against you? It's a great place to come to, that assurance of the believer. Now, unfortunately, not a lot of Christians press on to that maturity. They've been unfaithful to their Lord. They've been disobedient. They don't have that assurance of their salvation. The joy of their salvation is not there in full measure. And they can't really say, I am my beloved's and His desire is toward me. Not a very secure place to be. Much better to come to the Lord and really realize what He has done for you, understand His love for you, and then respond to Him in obedience. Now, verse 11, she says, come, my beloved, let's go forth to the field. Let's lodge in the villages. Let's get up early to the vineyards and see if the vine is budded, whether the grape blossoms are open and the pomegranates are in bloom. And all these emblems, of course, are sensual in their nature. She says, there I will give you my love. Now, at this point, of course, it's like they've been busy. They've been, you know, there's a break in the action here. They've went back to their normal lives, but they've gotten busy. Now she's calling him away. She's taking an initiative here to get them away together for a romantic weekend, a romantic getaway, stirring up some intimate feelings together. And certainly true in marriages. You can fall into a rut very easily, especially that there's certain times when the kids come, you know, into the marriage now, and you've got children, and the woman's total attention is toward the kids, and the husband feels kind of, he's the outside looking in, and that misbalance can come. Hey, she knows this. She takes the time to plan a getaway where it can be just the two of them. She's calling him away. And I love this, because when you get away and you leave the kids in good hands and you take a week end together. Now, it's great to have a weeknight, you know, on a regular basis that you really could spend some time together alone. But if you can't do that, at least plan some time to invest in your marriage. This is important because, you know what? It's easy to take each other for granted. And guys get so caught up in business, and women get so caught up in the children, and then they're not communicating. And then the more difficult times come when you're not communicating, you get a little bit of more intense fellowship, you know what I mean? And then you're not really responding to each other. So get away. Rekindle that flame. Do what it takes to rekindle that flame. One pastor friend of mine who's in a foreign country, been very, very busy because God is just exploding the work there, doing awesome things. And he said that he hadn't had a vacation in a couple of years because he'd just been so busy with some acquisitions of some property and some outreaches they've done and all these things that were going on. Well, a couple in the church really saw this, and they had a little vacation place in Austria, and they said, hey, look, we want you guys to go away and take a vacation. Take a couple of weeks off. Just spend some time. Here's the keys. Go. So they got away, but before they went, his wife said to him, honey, I'm not going to go unless you do something for me. He goes, what? She goes, I kind of want you to leave your cell phone here. What? He was in shock. You know, I mean, that's his lifeline to the ministry. It's like, how could they reach him? What if they have questions? You know, and he's like, I got to take that. And she goes, well, I'm not going to go then. Because you know what? It's so true for many of us as men. You know, we got our cell phones attached to us, and we're in bondage to it. You're out to dinner with your wife. Ming, hello, how you doing? What's going on? And you're carrying on a 10-minute conversation while your mate is over there, you know, thinking that she had your attention. And so, you know what? He wrestled with that, and he said, you know what? You're absolutely right. And he actually, it was like, okay, I'll leave it. And he left it, and they had an awesome time. In fact, the Lord did a marvelous work within their marriage. You know, it's needful, this getaway time. In verse 13, she says, the mandrakes give off a fragrance, and at our gates are pleasant fruits. All men are new and old, which I have laid up for you, my beloved. Look what she has done. She's actually set things out. She's even got the mandrakes there. And you might be wondering, well, what's a mandrake? Well, a mandrake, actually in the Old Testament, you get the feeling from some of the places that it's mentioned that it's a type of aphrodisiac. It's a type of, you know, fertility, you know, fragrance. A mandrake was it's actually a whitish green flower, but also that gives off small yellow apples. It's known as a lover's flower, and also the fruit is known as love apples. Back in Genesis chapter 30, Jacob, in his attempt to get Rachel, remember, he got tricked and Leah was given to him. And then he had to work another 7 years and he got Rachel. Now he's got two wives and they're in competition with each other. A lot of problems in that family. You know, God allows people to make decisions like that. His original plan was one man and one woman. But you see in the Bible the failure of even some of our heroes to follow that and the consequences that they suffer. Well, here's Jacob has these two wives and they're both vying for his attention. And Leah gets a hold of some mandrakes that her son finds, and Rachel wants the mandrakes because she hasn't been able to bear children yet. So she's desperate. She's thinking that that will help. And so Leah says, well, why should I give you my son's mandrakes? Jacob loves you more than me anyway. And she goes, well, look, if you give me the mandrakes, I'll give you, you know, it's like they had a schedule. It's my turn on Wednesday to be with him, your turn. I'll give you my night with him. So she trades her night with Leah to get the mandrakes because she supposes that might help with her pregnancy situation. Some type of aphrodisiac, some type of way that it stirred up those romantic passions. It's kind of funny looking around at all these guys writing notes now. Mandrakes, huh? Mandrakes, I'll write that down. And see if that'll... Where can I get some mandrakes? This is to what extent she's going to help that and stir that up. Now, chapter 8, even more expressive of her love, she says in verse 1, oh, that you were like my brother. Now, that doesn't sound too romantic. But let me tell you why she's saying that. She says, oh, that you are like my brother who nursed at my mother's breast. If I should find you outside, I would kiss you and I would not be despised. In that culture, any type of display of affection between husband and wife was frowned upon. It's funny, you know, when we're in Israel and we go up on the Temple Mount. And if I put my arm around my wife, there'll be one temple guard over there in a minute. You know, stop that. Stop that. Can't have any display of affection. So there's a little bit of a sense of propriety in that culture. So what she's saying is she goes, I want to kiss you so much. I can't do it in public. Oh, if you were my brother, then I could, because that would be acceptable. I wouldn't be despised. She says, I would lead you and bring you into the house of my mother, she who used to instruct me. I'd cause you to drink of spiced wine and of the juice of my pomegranate. So very sensual language here. In fact, even verse 3 is even more so. His left hand is under my head and his right hand embraces me. Very much descriptive of an intimate time together. Now, I'd mentioned before in this that this was not descriptive of an intimate time. And actually, I was referring to another passage and I made a mistake on that. This is very much an intimate embrace. And then she says in verse 4, again, another thing that's been repeated for the third time. Very significant. She goes, I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases. Now, this is the third time she uses this expression. The first time was in a time before they were committed in marriage, before they were even engaged. The meeting, the coming together and seeing him and the thought of being together was very powerful, very descriptive. And so she says, I charge you, O daughter of Jerusalem, by the does and by the gazelles, do not stir up or awaken love till it pleases. Remember, the does and the gazelles are very sensitive and any little thing could set them off. This is, in a way, how vulnerable we are to images, to things that might stir up our passions. When a boy meets a girl, they've got to be very careful that they don't jump to the physical because it stirs up passions way too quickly. In fact, the problem is that it will taint your objectivity. You will not be able to think as clearly. Once you start going to the physical and leave, you know, when a boy meets a girl and they start spending time together, they really need to focus on the relationship from the standpoint of brother and sister, of getting to know each other, of exercising self-control. You know, if you meet someone and you go out on the first date and you're holding hands walking down the street already, that's a problem. You're stirring up physical contact long before you don't even know if this is God's choice for you. You haven't even prayed. You haven't even sought the Lord. You don't even know whether that this is one that you really could be edified with and build a future together. Don't stir up passions. before its time. Very unwise, because what happens is young people do this and then they fall in their romantic, emotional attachment to each other. They have no objectivity anymore. All they can think of is we're meant to be together because my heart flutters, you know, and because they stirred up these passions. And then they get married and they have the most horrible time because they never even knew each other. Don't stir them up. The second time she mentions this, don't stir up these passions, the second time was during their courtship. When they were engaged, when she had the ring, when the promise was there, she said, do not stir up until love it pleases. Why? Because she wanted to be faithful and honor God. She wanted to honor her husband. Premarital chastity is a key to marital faithfulness and enjoyments. And there are statistics galore to back this up. Young people, let me tell you something here. Brian just gave me these statistics, although I knew and I had some in my files before. He gave me some fresh copies. Study after study after study after study shows that people most apt to report they're very satisfied with their current sex life are marrieds who strongly believe sex outside marriage is wrong. 72% of the members of this group report being very satisfied with their sex life, compared to only about 40-some percent of those who are single or those who have no objection to sex outside marriage. What a difference. Study after study show that marrieds are much happier than those that are promiscuous as singles. A monogamous married couples register the highest levels of sexual satisfaction in a study in 1992, and in 1982, 1975, and 1994, 1992. Every one of these studies shows, And counselors will tell you, that those who kept themselves pure before marriage are much more satisfied in the marriage in that area than couples who did not. Doesn't that go against the stupid counsel that you get from your peers or people who say, well, we're going to live together and see if we're compatible? Those people have the worst time of it. In fact, the divorce rate for couples who get married after living together is 50% higher than couples who keep themselves pure before they're married. Well, it doesn't surprise me when you know it's all about being faithful to God. So she's saying, don't stir up. We've got to keep ourselves, you know. I know that when Karen and I were engaged, there were temptations, and we had to make a covenant with each other. We were not going to, you know, be in any horizontal position, you know, either watching TV or anything together, because it's just too much of a temptation. We made a covenant not to be even alone after a while, because, you know, you just start thinking of that, and it was better to be around other couples. So we made that commitment to keep ourselves pure, and this is what she's saying. Now, the third time she mentions it, she's married now. They're in their season of their life enjoying each other, and she's saying, don't stir it up till it wakens. What is she talking about? It's appropriate now. The marriage bed is undefiled. So she could either be referring to the timing in their marriage, you know, where you've got to be careful that you don't defraud each other, to stir it up when you're both together and working together. Or it could be that she is so excited about this relationship, she wants that same enjoyment to be spread out to others. And so she's warning all the other young people, don't stir it up till it pleases. I think that's most likely the case. There's something in you, when you have a great marriage, you want others to enjoy that. You don't want people to be miserable. It's like you want others to enjoy that. You want to have them see that. And then the question is put, verse 5, by a relative or someone. Who is this coming up from the wilderness leaning upon her beloved? Notice how they've had their time of conflict, and now they're coming back from that weekend together, and they're just like in love. You know, they're leaning on each other, and it's noted by those observing. I awakened you under the apple tree. There your mother brought you forth. There she who bore you brought you forth. So she's just tickled pink. Now in verse 6, the Shulamite says to her beloved, set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm. And then she mentions four descriptions about love that are very crucial. In fact, Solomon is concluding this letter, this poetry, with this concept of love that should shake us to the foundation of what it really is all about. It's not about gazing in desired eyes across a candlelit table and whispering sweet nothings to each other. it's much deeper than that. It's not about anything other than the commitment you make and the fruit of that commitment. As we have noted each time, that foundation of agape love, which the Greek people in the fellowship here tell me I'm pronouncing horribly in the Greek. That's okay. Most of you know what is agape, which is the foundation, the commitment. Then phileo, which is that friendship love. Now you've built on the foundation this great friendship together as a husband and wife. And then the eros, which comes as the bloom. But notice what she says here about this. She says, for love is as strong as death. Jealousy as cruel as the grave. Its flames are flames of fire, a most vehement flame. Many waters cannot quench love, nor can the floods drown it. And if a man would give for his love all the wealth of his house, it would be utterly despised. Four things here about love. First of all, the strength of love. Love is as strong as what? Death. Kind of a strange combination. Love, death. Until you understand that the parallel is that death, none of us can escape. Death is certain. Death, no one of us have the power to overcome death on our own. There's only one that conquered death, and that was our Lord and Savior, who, because of his love toward us, went to his death. Because no greater love has anyone than he who lays his life down for his friends. Jesus laid his life down as the good shepherd for us because of his great love toward us. For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believe in him should not perish but have everlasting life. God demonstrated his love toward us by sending his Son to that cross, and Jesus went willingly. Love is as strong as death. Notice the second thing. If that's the strength of love, look at the jealousy of love. Jealousy as cruel as the grave. Cruel, translated also firm, in other words, unyielding, as hell. That grave is the Hebrew word for Sheol. The Sheol is the Hebrew word there that grave is translated from. It's also translated hell. Jealousy is as firm, as unyielding as hell. Its flames are flames of fire, a most vehement flame. Now, unfortunately, the translators, because sometimes back when a number of these translators were translating this, there was almost an anti-Jewish sentiment where they weren't really getting the full flavor of the Jewish word. And this is one of those places. It's a contracted form of the name of God. Many commentators that I read did not think that the name of God was even mentioned in this book, or in the book of Esther, for that matter. In Esther, it's mentioned a number of times in type. Here, it's right here very boldly, if you understand what this phrase is. When she says a most vehement flame, it's literally a flame of Yah, which is a contraction of Yahweh. This is the flame of God. Now, jealousy most of the time has a negative connotation. Jealousy most of the time in our experience is a selfish thing. I want you for myself. But in a marriage, you see, it's holy, it's right. There is a purity there. It would be a certain signal of a problem in a marriage if you didn't care whether your partner was out dating other people. I mean, that's not a good sign. The very fact there's that holiness there and that marriage covenant, there's a protection of that. There's a holy jealousy that God established. In fact, he's jealous over us, the Bible says. But not in a selfish way, but for our good. He is jealous for us. And it's powerful, the jealousy of love. But notice the third thing about love. Verse 7, many waters cannot quench love. The endurance of love. Many waters can't quench it, nor can floods drown it. It will keep coming back. You can't stop it. When that foundation of love there is in your life, nothing can stop it. And here's where the commitment is tested over and over and over and over again. You will have some incompatible situations. You know, what amazes me is the phraseology that is used and often to dissolve a marriage. Irreconcilable differences. Really. According to my Bible, many waters cannot quench love. Is there anything irreconcilable? I think we really need to reevaluate a lot of the thoughts and ideas we have picked up from the world and start challenging them with truth. And really start to hunker down, tighten the belt, and realize, you know, there are going to be some tough times ahead. There are going to be floods. There are going to be waters. There are going to be things that will try to stop your love and quench that desire. But if it's true love, If it's the foundation that you've laid is right in agape, it can't be stopped. The commitment is there after time after time after time. One particular author had said that he knew something was really radically changing when he came home from work one day and he opened the refrigerator and everything in it was stuff he liked. He was used to see all the stuff the kids liked. All of a sudden, what's going on? He knew something was up. And he sat down at the table and all the fine china was out there and the nice silverware. And he thought, what's going on here? Where's my regular crack plate and the spoon that the garbage disposal, you know, kind of did its number on? He was used to that. Now, all of a sudden, the best. He's put in the best. And his wife had decided to give him the preeminence, as the wife is called to bless him, to treat him like a king. Even though they weren't getting along, there was a lot of tension. He was a busy man, off with all of his business, constantly away, not really paying much attention to his wife. But she decided to do that for him, and it got his attention immediately. And he began to respond to it. See, she had found that the commitment was there. She started honoring that commitment, and they came together. And now they go around teaching about marriage. You know, God has used them and blessed them in many ways. And then the final thing about love is the value of love. If a man would give for love all the wealth of his household, he'd be utterly despised. In other words, it doesn't matter. You can't buy it. If you think you can buy love with all the wealth and all the money that you have, it's not going to work. The value of love is so much more. It cannot be purchased. It cannot be compared with anything else. Now, because of this foundation of love, there is again that, what I would call the evangelistic desire for others to experience this. I mean, I speak with this with a passion. I mean, you don't know how much I want marriages here at Calvary to be strong. And I know many of them aren't. And it burdens me. And I hear stories and it breaks my heart. And people leaving their husband or their wife, you know, and they've got their reasons. It breaks my heart. But you know what? When God begins to touch you in a way, you want others to experience that. You want them to have that same. And you know that it wasn't like, oh, Karen and I, we were always just so happy together. Now, there are times when, though I totally would not mention the word divorce, murder crossed my mind a number of times, you know. We're all challenged. We're normal. We have that intense fellowship. We've got, I mean, it was sometimes real tough. And I got to tell you, many times I had to just deny myself and suck it up and humble my pride. And you know what? This is right, though. This is the foundation. And when you see other couples just lightly casting off that commitment, breaks your heart. Here's that evangelistic desire in verse 8. Notice the Shulamite's brothers say, we have a little sister and she has no breasts. What shall we do for our sister in the day when she is spoken for? In other words, she's not ready for marriage. But what can we do to keep her, to preserve her? Notice what they say. If she's a wall, we'll build upon her a battlement of silver. And if she's a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. Now, you can figure this one out on your own, what's being said. It's pretty obvious. If she's a wall, we're gonna honor her, build upon her. But if she's a door, we're going to board her up. If she's a wall, that is, she's keeping herself chaste and pure. You know, we're going to honor her. If she's a door, she's just open to any old guy, and she gives herself away. And you know, again, if you're a young woman and you're giving your body away before you're married, you know, though you would never use the term prostitute, in reality, that's what you are. Well, I'm not asking for money. Well, no, but you're asking for affection. You're asking for attention. You're asking for, you know, popularity. And so you want that, and so you're giving sex to get that. You're selling your body for those commodities. It's still prostitution. It's not right. And you need to guard that. And in that culture, the brothers had a very big interest in keeping their sisters, you know, pure. And, you know, I can't help but draw the parallel here of how as a church and a fellowship, we need to watch each other's backs. If you know of a marriage in trouble, you know what? You need to intervene. You need to intercede and reach out to, if you're a guy, reach out to the guy and say, hey, man, come on, stick with it. Do the right thing. And if you know the woman, you know, ladies, reach out to the woman and say, hey, come on. And you know what? You get a couple, a man and a woman there, and this woman's got three or four women that are really encouraging her to be that better wife and to do the right thing. You got this guy over here, and a lot of guys are encouraging him. You know what? You're going to see some peace made in that family. You're watching out for each other. You're zealous for each other. This is what fellowship is all about. When you're isolated, you're in trouble. And here that desire to keep that. And of course, the Shulamite says, I am a wall and my breasts are like towers. And I became in his eyes as one who found peace. That is, she was greatly cherished because she did keep herself pure. She saved herself for him. And then in verse 11 and 12, Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Haman and leased the vineyard to keepers, and everyone is to bring for its fruit 1,000 silver coins. She makes a parallel here. Solomon, you remember that vineyard you had, and you leased it and you got money back for it, percentage of it? She says to Solomon, my own vineyard is before me. Now she's speaking figuratively about her body. He says, you, O Solomon, may have 1,000, and those who tend its fruit, 200. In other words, Solomon, you get the large percentage of who I am because of those who tended my garden. My brothers were there for me. My family was there for me. My family instilled in me these values. And what she's saying is, I'd like you to give them a percentage of that. Now, this could mean that she's saying, hey, well, I want you to give them a little salary for all the work they did. She could be saying that, you know, I want you to free me up to see my family because they were a large part of me. I'm not sure exactly where she's going with it, other than the fact that there is a debt that we owe. I thank incredibly my wife's parents for the way they raised her, and her mother took her to church and instilled her into those values and the foundation of Jesus. And you know what? To me, that was a price worth more than anything, because a godly woman's hard to find. You know, you can have that value. You can instill that value in your young kids. And you can give that foundation to them. And it's a treasure that person they eventually marry will thank you over and over and over for. And I can't do enough for my in-laws because of that foundation they laid. In verse 13, you who dwell in the gardens, the companions listen for your voice. Let me hear it. And the Shulamite says, make haste, my beloved, and be like a gazelle or a young stag in the mountains of spices. What they have learned in this chapter is the point to please each other. Love that pleases. This is not the love that speaks in the grandiose terms, but it's in the simple graces. The kindness, the thoughtfulness, the giving of oneself, the being uninhibited toward each other, and the erotic love that God intended. This is what the Lord has designed. Someone gave me, or my secretary actually passed this on to me, found it on the internet, 10 commandments of marriage. There are 10 commandments for husbands. I want you to listen to this. Thou shalt not take thy wife for granted, but will honor and respect her as thy equal. Thy highest allegiance, except God, shall be to thy wife, not to thy relatives or friends. Thou shalt frequently tell thy wife how important and valuable she is to thee. Thou shalt hold thy wife's love by the same means that you won it. Thou shalt actively establish family discipline with thy wife's help. Remember to do all the little things for thy wife when you say you will. Keep thine eyes on thine own wife, not thy neighbor's. Thou shalt make every effort to see things from thy wife's point of view. Thou shalt not fail to kiss thy wife every morning. And thou shalt not be stingy with thy wife when it comes to money. Those are the 10 commandments for husbands. Then the 10 commandments for wives. Yeah, you thought you were going to get away with that, didn't you? Guys are always telling me, I'm always picking on the guys. You know, what about the women? All right, ladies. Expect not thy husband to give thee as many luxuries as thy father has given thee after many years of hard labor. 2, thou shalt work hard to build thy house with the husband that you have, not fantasizing about the one that could have been. Thou shalt not nag, hit him with thine frying pan. Thou shalt coddle thy husband and be a warm wife. Remember that the frank approval of thy husband is more to thee than the side glances of many strangers. Thou shalt not yell at thy husband, but will be a gentle and quiet spirit. Permit no one to assure thee that thou art having a hard time of it. I don't know what that means, but thou shalt not fail to dress up for thy husband with an eye to please him, as thou didst before marriage. Thou shalt submit to thy husband from the heart and allow him to be the head of the household. And finally, thou shalt assure thy husband and others that he is the greatest man alive. Now, you know, the funny thing about this is they're called commandments, but I don't know if you noticed that in reality, they're choices that you make. They're choices that you make to become more pleasing to your partner, which is really the love that pleases. You want. You see, if it was a commandment, thou shalt, thou shalt, thou shalt, you know, like, okay, I've got to do this. That's one thing. But if it's the desire to please your partner, it's like it becomes a challenge and a delight and a joy and a desire out of that love. The same is true, of course, with your walk with God. I pity those whose walk with God is based upon rules and regulations and scruples and guilt and, you know, shame and, you know, everything's about the appearance and doing this and don't doing that. And they don't just enter in to that acceptance of God's love and a willing desire to please Him and obey Him and trust Him, because that's what the relationship is all about.